together, opening your word, looking ahead to your plan for the ages. We thank you for your love, your grace in our lives, and your redemptive plan that redeemed us as we were irredeemable on our own. And you loved us enough to provide for a way of redeeming us, but it meant your sacrifice. We don't fully understand that. We can't understand it. We thank you for what you're doing in our lives. You want us to grow spiritually. You want us to grow cognitively. You want us to grow in our interpersonal skills and use everything you've given us to grow and mature and to minister to others and have an impact in your kingdom transcendently forever. I pray that this may be a useful session and that you be with us. Help me to be as clear as necessary, and that we all get what we need to take home from this. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Well, a few years ago here, I did a session from using Micah 6:8 as a foundational approach to values or to virtues. And I don't know, probably none of you, were you in that? You were in that. Well, that's where we're going to launch. So this is part two. And but I'll do about a two-minute recapitulation of that. Micah 6:8, if any of you memorize it, I know people that memorize it. I know people that have it as a plaque on their wall. They don't necessarily know why, but they have it on a plaque on their wall. And so years and years ago, 30, 40 years ago, I developed with an adult class I was teaching. So we thought mutually together. They get a lot of credit for helping me think about it. But what's going on in Micah 6:8? God consolidates everything he has said to Israel into that verse. Rabbi Zacharias made that observation. God consolidated everything he'd said to Israel about living, the virtues of living, into that verse. And there are only three virtues in that verse. It's not a long list. When we, you know, no matter who you read Socrates or Plato or John Maxwell or your favorite John Piper or whoever, typically they reduce virtues to a list. Well, humans can't remember a list very well, much beyond five items. So when you see a long list, you're not going to remember it. And so we begin to ask ourselves, what's going on in Micah 6:8? Why those virtues? Why, if you study the word, why is a great question. Why did he say it that way? Why did he use those words or that Greek word instead of another one? Or what's his concern about the people that he's writing to? So why is a great hermeneutical question. So that was a question we asked in Micah 6:8. And as we looked at it, there are three virtues. One is, and they end up being a triad of virtues. So that you do, he says, that you do justly, mishpat's the Hebrew word. It's the idea of doing the right thing, or at the personal level, rectitude or integrity. We're kind of familiar with those words. So at the pinnacle of the triangle, we put integrity, we all know that word, doing the right thing, or you could put righteousness. Integrity in that you, what? Love, what's the usual translation? Love, that you love mercy, but the word isn't mercy, it is hesed, which is probably one of the most powerful words in the Old Testament. And it probably is guttural, right, Wes? It's kind of, because once in a while you'll see it with a C. Hesed. Yeah. And but it means, we don't have a good English word for it. Maybe devotion or devoted love. It's a blend of loyalty and love. I'm committed to you. It's a committed love. There's discussions in the theological literature. Is it covenantal? Once in a while you hear that. A covenantal love, married love, David and Jonathan. It's a committed love. Carries the idea of a loyalty, so loyal love. So that's in the title. I'm thinking of hesed when we get in the subject of part two. So we're on just the review now of part one. Hesed, and that you walk humbly with your God. And what attribute is that? Humility. Right. Yeah, I'm reading an article. In fact, I have it brought it with me, a little article from Harvard Business Review that is titled, "If Humility is Important for Good Leadership, why are so many leaders so narcissistic?" And we'll talk a little bit about narcissism and kind of its role in our human character. Now, as you look at each one of these have a, you almost think of this as a molecule. They have characteristics around integrity. So when you think integrity, what kind of attributes do you think of? If you were to make a list. Truthfulness, honesty, diligence maybe. Yeah, reliability in a sense. That's right. At least he's reliable in that he knows or she knows what she's doing. Excellence. So, and diligence. Somebody says, well, how's diligence related to integrity? Well, in Proverbs, the sluggard has a set of characteristics that go with it. He's definitely not diligent. The sluggard, why doesn't the sluggard get up in the morning and go to work? He tells himself that there is a lion in the streets. Is there really a lion in the streets? No, he's lying to himself. And he's going to lie to his boss when he gets to work. And so good managers need to be able to discern the difference between excuses and reasons. An excuse is there's a lion in the street. So the sluggard, part of his characteristic is that he lies to himself, and he probably lies to others about his not lack of diligence. So there's a tight connection between diligence and integrity, for example. Well, as you study it, you kind of grow, oh, yeah, I see. What other attribute is there that goes with integrity? If you're a truth teller, you're honest, you are also a truth seeker. Right. So a mark of integrity is I want to know the truth. And Proverbs has a lot to say about that. You're a truth seeker, even if the truth may not be what you want to know. And so there's a whole body of science and so forth on how to get at the truth. My background, you're probably thinking, what's a doctor doing in this area? Well, my background is I'm trained in preventive medicine, public health, and disease investigation. And if you go into that field, you're going to end up running something. And so you're also trained in management, finance, and all of those skills, as well as disease investigation, disease control, understanding diseases. And so you're kind of this crazy blend of management, leadership, and inferential thinking. So what I ended up running after a few years was the Kansas City Health Department, about a $50 million agency. And so I had several hundred people, and I was a trial by fire. And since I was a young guy, I just served in Vietnam. I just back from the Army, additional training. And after about 2 years, I got asked by the city manager. Kansas City is a city management form of government, and he had a good cabinet. And I thought that people say, well, did you look at any other jobs? Yeah, we did. In fact, one back in Minneapolis, our hometown. But I like the form of government in Kansas City, and I like the city manager. He was a good city manager. I felt I could learn under him, and he had a very seasoned cabinet around him. So I said, man, I can join that cabinet. I'm the young kid, and I can learn from those men, those seasoned men and women, seasoned men and women. And, you know, after 23 years, I was the old guy. So I devoted myself to how can I be a good leader? And I immersed myself in the leadership literature, management literature, and the city would welcome that. The managers let me go to, you know, if I felt I needed training in system dynamics, he'd let me go to system dynamics training. Strategy thinking. He sent me to Wharton for finance. So what we're going to do, and I'll pick up the pace. Who's got the cards, by the way? Anybody? Kay, you want to signal me? I don't know where they are. Here they are. I don't know when we're over, so you just... So that's a countdown. Same thing with love. So think about what attributes are... associated with love. When you think of hesed, what things come to mind? Yeah, there's an element of loyalty in it, right? goes with love? What comes out of love for somebody? Not necessarily romantic love, just a committed love for them, an agape love, huh? A willingness to sacrifice, but that's not quite right, because what other of these does it take to sacrifice? Hint, hint. Humility. So sacrifice is a blended virtue of caring about that person and my willingness to sacrifice myself. So servant leadership is a blend. So what we're going to do next, I'm getting ahead, but we're going to blend these virtues. So you begin to experiment intellectually. You're going to blend the virtues and new virtues emerge. And that's the magic of Micah 6:8. As you blend the virtues, Micah 6:8 flowers into a whole host of virtues, the underlying virtues of which are humility, loyal love, and integrity. So we'll do one level down very quickly, but loyalty, how about respect? How about kindness? How about thoughtfulness? How about protection of the other person you love? How about the desire to edify them? Desire to grow the other person. You cheer their growth. Sounds familiar? Pretty close to Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13. You can go through that. Okay, now that's not done. This is a long list. Humility, then. What kind of attributes come to mind when we think of humility? So I'm kind of teaching you very quickly how to think through the deeper spiritual principle in Micah 6:8. So if you're humble, you can do what? You can forgive. Go ahead. You can submit. Excellent. Forgive. You can honor others. Right. You can rejoice with them in a sense, can't you? And if you love them, so a little bit of that in 1 Corinthians 13, you rejoice in the truth and you rejoice when they are doing well. You're not jealous or envious of how they're doing. Okay. If you can forgive, what else can you do? What does humility allow you to do? Ask for forgiveness. Yeah, confession. Yeah, what else? The ability to listen. Patience. And here's one of those blended terms. Patience, in a sense, is a blended attribute because you're patient with somebody and you're willing to kind of go with them a little bit. Makrothumio is an attribute of love, but it is patience. It's translated patience most of the time. And giving them room to be them, in a sense, you sort of tell yourself to get over it. They have an attribute that gets under your skin. Paul would probably say, good place for makrothumio. Just get over it. Give them room. Be big-hearted toward them.
Forbearance.
Yeah, the same idea. There are three levels in the New Testament in the area of patience. One is makrothumio. Another one, which is just, you just tell yourself, don't let it bother me. Then the next one is, anakamia. There's three. And then hypomony or something like that. Yeah. And one is, the next level up is forbearance, which means you kind of grit your teeth. You can't just kind of overlook it, but you grit your teeth. You're not going to let it get to you. And then the last one is, I'm going to forbear for a while. I'm going to bear up under it for a while, but the time is coming when I may have to deal with it. We have maybe with your kids. You're watching an attribute. You're going to see, is this going to disappear, or am I going to have to deal with it? God goes through all three of those with Israel. There's things he overlooks. There's things that he puts up with for a while, and there are things he warns them that sooner or later he's going to deal with it. Anyway, so now we're going to blend these. And if you blend them, if you blend integrity and love, a new virtue emerges, and that's the virtue of authenticity or trustworthiness. No hidden agendas. You are trustworthy. Now, just kind of a little side note, you say, well, gee, doesn't integrity make you trustworthy? Well, if an IRS agent called on you and said, I'd like to audit your books, would you trust them? Most people in the room would say, you got to be kidding. Maybe, they may have all the integrity in the world, but why wouldn't you trust them? Where's their heart? Uncle Sam, the Treasury Department. Absolutely. You need both. You want to know, where's that person's heart, and do they have integrity? Put those two things together, and you have trustworthiness. Yeah. And that's interesting. And once in a while, you see it in Scripture. He cares for me, and I trust him. He keeps his appointments. He does what he says he's going to do, and so forth. So this development of trustworthiness. Trustworthiness, it turns out, is an extremely important attribute in holding a church together or an organization. Notice its dependence on love. Because when love goes out, one of the first signs you'll see in your church is diminishment of trustworthiness. You're not really sure about them. So we're going to come back a little bit and talk about the dynamics for a leader. How does a leader detect loss of love in an organization or in their church? So you blend humility and hesed, and what do you get? Loving, you're willing to sacrifice yourself. You develop a generous heart. So generosity emerges from your willingness to subordinate your needs to the needs of somebody else, and we call that generosity. And things like being able to create win-win solutions, be collaborative, attributes like that come out of that. There's some powerful research coming out now in the secular research world, secular leadership world, on the importance of a generous heart. It's called a giver thinking. There are three studies out of Stanford. Stanford even has a, no, it's not Stanford. A book by Professor Wharton is called Give and Take. And it's a study of three attributes. The givers, the takers, and most of us are transactional. In other words, we think fairly in a sense, tit for tat. So we'll come back to that. What are the signs? And so as a leader gets more sophisticated, they begin to think, you can think more sophisticatedly about the dynamics in your church or your organization. Is this healthy? Am what I'm seeing okay? So we'll say generosity. Okay, almost done with this. Okay, and we blend humility and strength, integrity, doing the right thing. You're good at what you do, diligence, excellence, but you're humble. A little bit harder, and the term that's used translated in the Bible throws us off. It's strength. It means strength under control, or strength in service, either to God or to somebody else. Meekness, exactly right. And we have a terrible mental model of meekness. It has nothing to do with weakness or mildness or anything like that. In fact, the Greeks used the term, proudus, for their war horses. Their war horses were anything but weak and mild and so forth. But a proudus war horse was well trained so that rider, that cavalryman, could take that horse, and they were big horses, and with all the bucklery and everything, the shields and the spears and the swords and the weight of that horse, the horse had to carry all of that into the line of battle. Now, is a horse a prey animal or a predator animal? Horses do not willingly charge lines of battle. They run. They are prey animals. So for a horse is going against everything in its instinct when that cavalry charge, and yet it's obeying what that rider expects of us. That's meekness. And we go, whoa, it's strength under control. Americans like meekness in their heroes. starting with John Wayne, Texas, you know, Walker, Texas Ranger. They did the right thing, but they could shoot straight. They could engage in fights or whatever. We admire people like that. They were dependable, and they had strength, they had competence, and yet they subordinated themselves to the needs of whatever their call was.
Discipline.
Yes, right. You might say disciplined strength would not be a bad take on meekness. So we've been around the circle now. Now, it's interesting, in the Sermon on the Mount, Beatitudes, which is early in Matthew, Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit. And so where does that go? Humility. Blessed are those who weep, and they're willing to seek, you know, they're sorry for, probably, for their sins, humility. Then blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who seek after righteousness. Blessed are those, the merciful, comes down here, he jumped this one. Blessed are the merciful, then blessed are the pure in heart. And pure in heart is what? Authentic. Yeah, you can see through them in a sense, like an alabaster vase. And then he centers, and then blessed are those who are peacemakers. And the peacemaker needs a skill of win-win. He goes right around Micah 6:8. And then he comes back to what I will call faithful courage. Which empowers all of these. But you can't have these two effectively without humility. So humility is an absolute necessity to love and to follow. Okay. So we're going to focus the rest of our time on love and not love and see where that takes us. So that's Micah 6:8 part 1. And that's worth about a day's seminar. So. By the way, I've done this for a lot of secular organizations who want training in ethics, they think ethics, and they love it. I just don't tell them where it comes from. They love it. They first, and you can look up the normal list of ethics, and they want, I'm asking, where's love? So that's what we're going to talk about the rest of this session. Why is love so important? Because even the leadership literature, the respectable organization, Stanford, just came out with a book. A professor at Stanford teamed up with a professor at Michigan and wrote a book on the importance of compassion in organizational leadership. And it turns out Stanford has a center for compassion and altruism in organizational behavior. So I'm going to just kind of tease your interest a little bit. So let's talk about love and not love. So if this end of this spectrum is love, put it up above so I got more room down below. What's this end of the spectrum? Anybody?
Not
love. Well, it's more than that. It's actually an active maliciousness toward the other person. And we call that
hate.
Right. Yeah, so, but you're going to go through the zone of not love. And we will call that the zone of indifference. You're indifferent to the other person. No love, no hatred. You just don't care about them. Yep. So let's start our list. Let's go back then to our list of attributes under love. And what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, if a church or an organization is moving this direction, and what's going to trigger that, and we'll talk about some of the triggers in a church, what does that look like? So if we understand what love looks like, maybe we'll understand what not love and then hatred looks like. And so let me just start listening, right? This is where I look at I said respect. So now we're going to start to think organizationally. You respect each other. Respect itself has a lot of implications. How do I treat you? Am I respectful? So, you know, you can use your imagination and say, what is disrespect? What's the opposite of respect, by the way? Contempt. If any of you are familiar with Gottman's work, the marriage research guy up in Seattle, University of Washington, he's written several books on marriage. They got, by watching couples dialogue, they got to the point where they'd sit a couple down, and they would watch them and video them, but watch through a glass, watch them dialogue. And they got so good that Gottman could predict within minutes whether that couple was headed for divorce or not. It's astounding. Maybe even a few seconds. And what did he learn to watch for? Disrespect. Contempt. Did his wife roll her eyes when he said something? And it's a great study, but that's where they learned to pick up disrespect and contempt very early. And you've got, of course, one couple, then there's a thing called repairing. So I'll put that up. Are you able to repair a relationship or a conversation? Couples that hold their marriage together are repairing, because you're disagreeing. You've got things you disagree with. And so repairing is coming back and fixing it. Oh, dear, I didn't mean that, you know. Or, you know, some sign of love. You repair that. Now, hopefully, over time, you need to repair less. But repairing is a sign of love. I care enough about the relationship to pay attention. The person comes back and repairs it. We had a pastor several years ago who was a tease. And I kidded him once. I said, Pastor, he teased our assistant pastor mercilessly, in some cases, publicly. And I said, you need to understand the difference between teasing and kidding. What does teasing do? Teasing, what is the effect of teasing? Huh?
It undermines.
It diminishes. That's right. You're diminishing the other person. You're teasing them about something. Yeah. And kidding is designed to build a relationship. When I kid you, it means we're close enough to kid each other. The profound difference. If you can't tell the difference, don't engage in either one because you're going to get in trouble. Okay. Well, we've got along. Yeah, go ahead.
A person that does not show respect does not understand something like self-deprecating. If you're self-deprecating,
yes.
You can
use the Bible. Yes. Yes. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Self-deprecating kind of sends a signal that I'm willing to keep you elevated in a sense. Yeah. In fact, self-deprecating people are under the right circumstances. I mean, if they're always doing it. Sometimes it's a habit they get into. Key and I know somebody who just constantly self-deprecates. And what do you do? What's she looking for? Ratification. Exactly. You come back and you ratify them. Oh, you're really not that bad a cook. Or you're really not that bad, you know, whatever. And self-deprecation, in a sense, makes people more open to what you have to say. Interesting in the studies. Yeah. Okay.
Love, yeah. It's very necessary, since you brought that up, very necessary that you know how to deal with conflict resolution.
Yes. Yeah.
That's part of love.
Absolutely. Yeah, and repairing is a key part of that. Conflict resolution is so for a leader of an organization, you're dealing with conflict throughout the organization all the time. So Chuck's point is that if you don't understand, conflict, in fact, in a sense, it's conflict repair, conflict healing. Some people use the term conflict management. Well, there are a lot of conflict management styles that are not very effective. So think of conflict repair, conflict healing, conflict resolution. You want to resolve a conflict. Now, it doesn't mean you end up agreeing. Husband and wife don't agree on a lot of things, but they still hold a relationship together. And the important things they resolve, and they find fixes for things. How to deal with an issue in the house, or, you know, what's the next car going to be, or whatever. They bring differences of thinking, but they find a way to come together. And we talk a little bit about that in a couple minutes. So warmth toward the person. You want to be with them. Proximity. Speak up. What do you think is another one might be? You want to understand them. Which is important for good dialogue, right? Compassionate curiosity. I was listening to a talk on, guy was doing a little talk, I don't know whether he's a pastor or whatever, and he had his 5 points on marriage, and you know what's important in a marriage. And I'm sitting there thinking, there's something that made our marriage click that went on for 40, almost 50 years. We've been married over 50 years. You know what it was? Compassionate curiosity. I wanted to understand how she ticked. And she wanted to understand how I ticked. And so we'd be on the road, and we'd be listening to the book, You Just Don't Understand Me, which is by the linguist Deborah Tannen, for example. Fun book. And how women think differently, how they communicate differently. And so we'd be laughing. But the purpose was to help understand each other. Men show love differently than women do. And so I'm not going to ask Kay to change, or she's not going to ask, we do. I mean, we shift toward each other in a bit, but I increasingly over the years understood what she needed. She began to understand what I needed. And so we, over all these years, compassionate understanding. Same way with any friendship relationship. I want to understand you better. And it's great for dialogue because you take that skill into a team or a board meeting and you... You learn the skill of saying, John, you just said something a minute ago that I'm not sure I understood, and I'm tempted to draw this conclusion, but I may be wrong. And you said this, and this is the inference I'm tempted to draw. It probably is going to be a negative inference. He wants to kill the project or whatever. And that gives John an opportunity to say, he for one thing, has to admit that's what he said. You may have misheard him. He said, that's not exactly what I said. Well, he can correct himself. And then he said, oh, that's not what I meant. I meant this. Well, what have you just done? Deepened your understanding in the communication, kept yourself from jumping about four rungs up the inference ladder, drawing a wrong inference because you tend to respond to your inferences because you believe your inferences, which are likely wrong. Humans tend to draw negative inferences. It's automatic. It's part of the flesh. So you have to be aware of that and say, I really want to understand what you said. Now, did you say this? Did I hear you right? Or I saw you roll your eyes. You know, no, I got a contact lens and it's out of place. You know, you might discover something you didn't. And so I'll put a few more up. So understanding, repairing, kindness, helpfulness, you know, the stuff that we had up there before. protection. Do people understand protection in a disciple? If you're going to form discipleship groups, if you're a leader in your church, understand the principle of protection. Because when you get deep enough in a discipleship relationship, you're probably going to have to find a way to protect that person. I had an interesting conversation with Bill Thrall a few years ago. He's True Face, part of the True Face group out of John Lynch and that group out of Phoenix. And we were talking about discipling, and he said, you learn to also protect them against their weaknesses, or you protect their weaknesses is what he said. And I said, you mean protect them from their weaknesses? He said, no, protect their weaknesses. And he gave me an example that has stuck with me to this day. He was in a small discipleship group, and one of the men confessed to pornography, particularly was on the road. He turned on the adult channels, when he was on the road and watched pornography. And that shouldn't surprise us, because what percent of men in the average church watch pornography? Yeah, somewhere between 40 and 80, that's right. How many youth pastors are into pornography? Like 50%. It's scary. I mean, it is really scary. So this friend of his said, yeah, I'd like to turn on the adult channels. So Bill asked him, when's your next trip? He said, well, Monday I go to Atlanta. And he said, well, where are you staying? Well, I'm staying at the Atlanta Hilton. When do you think you'll get there? Oh, about 5 o'clock. He said, well, when you check in, call me. And so he said, I will. And so about a little after 5 o'clock, the phone rang. And this is John, you know, I'm in room 820. And Bill said, okay, now I want you to go down to the front desk and tell them to turn off the adult channels. And he said, I can't do that. And Bill said, why can't you? He said, because there's this really cute girl down there, you know. And Bill says, do it and call me back when you're back in your room. And a few minutes later, the phone rang and it was John. And he said, you won't believe what happened. He said, I went down to the front desk, and I kind of waited for the crowd to clear, you know, and I called her over, and he says, I'm in 820. He says, I'm John so-and-so. He says, would you turn off the adult channels to my room? And she said, you must be a Christian. And he said, how do you know? I am. And she says, because only the Christian men asked me to turn the channels off. Now, Bill couldn't protect him from his weakness. He protected his weakness. That's part of discipleship. Yeah. So that idea of being able to detect, to go deep enough with a friend to say, how can I protect you, is good. It's important. It's part of love. So, and most churches do not. They have Bible studies, small groups, grace groups, you know, whatever you want to call them, but they don't go deep enough for real discipleship kind of interaction. And that's part of the world. There's emerging a lot of literature now on discipleship. That's what I'm curious what GES is going to do with it next year. Thoughtfulness. Sharing the gospel. Most of us do not care enough, love the unsaved enough to feel motivated to share the gospel with them. People who have a passion for sharing the gospel, some may do it out of duty, but a lot of them do it out of compassion. Now, I want to tell you something, just read you something. And I'm not sure. A little book on sharing the gospel. From the conversation with Penn and, yeah, here it is. Penn and Teller. People recognize that? Penn and Teller? World-class magicians. Penn Jillette is an atheist. And after performances and so, people, Christians would come up and try to witness him, give them a brochure or something like that. And his friend, I think Teller, somebody else, another atheist friend, why do you put up with that? And this is what he said. He said, how much do you have to hate somebody not to share the gospel or to proselytize? How much do you have to hate somebody to believe that everlasting life is possible and not tell them? Yeah. That's an atheist saying that. He says, I admire their attempt to proselytize because it tells me that what? They care about me. Yeah. So sharing the gospel, sign of love. Generosity, having a giver mentality, overlooking things, macrothumia we talked about, edifying. How do I edify that person? Okay, I got a couple of others. Can you rejoice with them? Now, a lot of those sound kind of familiar, don't they? Right out of 1 Corinthians 13. I think that in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul, he's talking about agape love, but I think he had hesed in mind, and he's looking at hesed love through, he's looking at the triangle, in a sense, through the love angle. So love allows you to subordinate yourself. Love doesn't puff itself up. Love doesn't, and by the time you're done, by the time Paul finishes that list, he's dealt with all three points of the triangle, the Micah 6-8 triangle, manifested through love. So that's why love, if you understand it, is so powerful. And you don't, you know, other natural things come out of it, like the willingness to follow Christ. But anyway, okay, now we're going to talk about what are the signs of slippage, because that's, and what can cause it? What causes migration? Both besides human nature, but a lot of it is human nature. So as a church leader, you're watching your church and you begin to see symptoms. So of this list or other things you can think of, what are some signs of slippage toward the zone of indifference or actually to hatred? Lack of respect, right. Contempt. So we'll go through lack of. In fact, you could put lack of in front of most of these, right? And over here is contempt. Lack of willingness to make the effort to repair. Lack of concern, right? So you could take most of them. What else? Be with, right? Be with. So what is a sign of that you're losing your care for that other person? You're not going to repair. You're not going to not return phone call. Dodge them. You know, you watch. We had a situation in our church where somebody tried to repair and the pastor dodged. He's, by the way, he's a beloved pastor. He wants to be a beloved pastor. And a lot of pastors want to be beloved. But an attribute that can go with that is conflict averse. Yeah, dodging conflict. The problem with dodging conflict and not being able to repair it is that it gets shifted someplace else. And in a church setting, and I see this in some churches I deal with. When I stepped down from the health department, I had additional training in quality, and then I took training in governance. I had served on probably 30 governing boards, including ministry boards, church boards, hospital boards, foundation boards, United Way board, and so forth. So I got interested in governance. Case suggested that I go to Atlanta, take training under John Carver, and I did, and his model is called policy governance. You use policies to give direction to the organization, to the pastor, to the CEO. And then the phone started ringing. So for what, Kay, about 17 years now, or 15 years, I've been consulting across North America, mainly to governing boards in governance and strategy and leadership issues. So that's what I've been doing. So I've seen a variety. And churches started calling me a few years ago. I don't go looking for churches. Churches are complex. They're complex politically and so forth. But they call. They know, you know, I'm a believer. They know I'm an evangelical. And they can trust that, even though they know I may not believe exactly as they believe. So I've consulted to assemblies, churches, and evangelical free churches, and who else? Bible churches, Calvary Chapel, one of my clients, who was Capon and Kraus, a big accounting firm, called me in to talk to the Calvary Chapel. This isn't a Brethren church. It's part of the Chapel family of churches. Fort Lauderdale, like the seventh largest church in the country. And they rejected what I had to say. And several months later, Greg Capon called me and he said, "Did you just hear about Calvary Chapel, Fort Lauderdale?" I said, "No." And he said, "Their pastor resigned because he had an affair going with us, one of the ladies in the church." And pastors, that's a lonely job, being a pastor, by the way. I won't go into that, but it's not an easy job. And pastors come out of the seminary kind of bright-eyed, starry-eyed. They think, "I'm going to teach the word and maybe nurture people." And life's not like that when you're a pastor. The studies show that 70% of your time is management, solving conflicts, running things, being sure things get done, things are ready, you know, and negotiating space and for different groups, and all that stuff's going on in your life. And I think it's a tough job, and it burns people out. The average burnout rate of the young seminarian is six to 10 years, something like that, and they're out of there. I think it's sometimes easier to run a company than a church. So, but I see these, and often the deacons or the elders, most of the churches I've consulted to have had elders, their elder form of governance. And so an elder is supposed to be spiritually mature, able to teach, right? But what does a typical church do when they search for an elder? Businessmen. They're looking for good businessmen, business head. So the church board gets turned into a business meeting. And usually most boards react to what's put in front of them. So if the pastor puts a finance report in front of them or his monthly report or something like that, that's where the board will go. And what does the board react to? What's put in front of them. So part of governance is learning to teach them to think strategically and set your parameters, what you're going to put up with in terms of behavior, what you're not going to put up with, and what the ends of the church are. What's your purpose, pastor? You can use any means possible as long as you don't violate our prescriptions to create a great church. Almost invariably, when the elders do that, create that vision statement or that end statement, it is around discipleship. Whether it's a Church of Christ, I didn't mention that denomination, I have a Church of Christ client, an Assemblies church, an E-Free church, they go to the idea of discipling. They realize that Matthew 28 is kind of the core of what you're about, and then they'll do a list of what does a mature disciple look like. Now what's happening almost invariably is the pastor sitting there looking like a deer in the headlights because he never was taught in seminary, how do I create a church that disciples? After all, I'm teaching them the word 30 minutes a week. No, forget Wednesday nights and Sunday nights and, you know, or youth groups on Sunday night. And often the board and the pastor, the board will say, "Come on, pastor, let's get going and, you know, put the plan together." And the pastor is not a strategist, doesn't have a clue on how to create a church that disciples, and doesn't reach out to others because he feels isolated. And not used to connecting with other churches. Maybe his budget's limited to what he can go to and so forth. And the elders don't have a clue. You know, they're businessmen after all. So how does he put together a group of men and women maybe and go to the literature and learn and call other pastors and say, "Hey, you've got a reputation for building a discipling program. What materials are you using? How are you doing that?" Doesn't happen. And so often a gap will develop between the pastor and the board. And Wes and I know a church that where the pastor, the board kept gentle pressure on, and the pastor decided it wasn't for him. And so you're watching for disrespect. Now, if your win-win is an attribute of love, being able to put a win-win, but if you start to think win-lose, you know, zero-sum thinking, what you get, I lose, what I get. So takers think that way often. and I won't have a lot of time to talk about giver mentality, but one of the emerging areas of research is we're wired in one of three ways. We're givers, takers, or transactional. Most people tend to be transactional. It turns out that givers are better leaders. They build better networks. They build better teams. They build better churches. The only trick is to keep them from being taken advantage of. So that is a great study. How do I identify the givers in my church? I'm going to talk about financial givers. They're just natural. I'll do something for you. Or I know somebody I can connect you with. Or I've just read a good book. Or I'll buy it for you. You know, that kind of, they don't expect anything in return. Their heart is to see you develop. That's called a giver mentality. And that's coming out of the secular research. You know, it's really interesting. So if you understand the word, you can go to the secular world and say, yeah, that aligns with, you know, biblical principles. And giving heart comes out of love. And the willingness to set yourself aside a little bit. What else is going on? So over here, under hatred, we had contempt and antipathy, malice, animosity, the desire to punish, wish you were gone, because the ultimate of that is murder, and not sharing the gospel, envying. So win-lose, when you think win-lose, it's an envy-jealousy dyad when you stop to think about it. What they have, you want a piece of, so you're envying them, and they want a part of what you have, and you don't want to give very much up of that. So jealousy's activated over here, you're envying and you're jealous. And, of course, for the other party, it's the flip side of that. Terrible dynamics. Terrible dynamics. Now, you know where it starts to happen in a church? If you've got an entity that's a separate entity from the church, a school, typically, that's an invitation to this dynamic. Because you start talking about the school as they. When you hear that kind of language, whether you're an elder, or a pastor, or a leader, then kind of your antenna should go up. When you hear this they, we, they thinking, you're headed to the left side of that chart. And you're going to move toward win-lose thinking. So I've encountered that now about three times. And the more they head that way, the more of these other things on the left side under hatred begin to show up. You avoid. You don't return phone calls. You deal by email. Terrible way to communicate. Don't dialogue. You can't dialogue via email. Not repairing. What's another sign of disrespect? Name calling. So we're tempted to give. Now we see that in theology. So a theology you don't like, you're tempted to give a name to that's a bit disparaging. You just moved yourself toward the left side of that graph. So when Tom Stegall wrote his book, and Kay and I have been to the Duluth Bible Church, and Stegall came out of that, he called people who had grace theology, he gave them a name. Now the pastor doesn't do that, but Stegall does. And what did he call it? Well, that's one. Another one was the crossless gospel. Yeah. It's a pejorative term. So when you're tempted to use a pejorative term, you're sliding to the left of that graph. Yeah. So leadership, I can't teach you the whole pamphlet. I just want to raise your curiosity and your awareness that leaders are called to a higher level. The complexity is greater and your perceptiveness has to be raised. I can run through if you guys are taking notes. Do I? Avoiding, not repairing, finding things wrong, me first, zero-sum thinking, benighted sense of spiritual direction. You become sly in the way you deal with other people or with the school or with whatever the other entity is. And I did this for the Vaughn board. I tried it out on them as a devotional. And I heard we have a pastor who's an executive pastor of a big church in Winnipeg. lean over to one of his friends, and he said, boy, did that hit the bullseye. And that big church has a school, and that's the stuff they're struggling with. You gotta be intentional, you gotta be alert, and you gotta detect these things, and you gotta be a repairer. You gotta say, hey guys, this is a we situation, not a we they situation. You gotta think collaboratively. You gotta keep bringing it back, and to save the because it will deteriorate. It's gonna head in only one direction. It will not automatically repair itself. It will deteriorate. And so the leader has to have the ability to step in early. The earlier, the better. And Kay's given me the stop signal. I'll share this with you on that subject. Proverbs 1:2. And Wes can help me. I used to think there were five steps. There really are five steps in the wisdom cycle. And the second step, you got to go through Musar, which is the diligence of learning. And then the next level is developing discernment. But in Proverbs 1:2, he talks about discerning to discern, or to develop discernment, bin and binya. Bin is the verb, or it's an attribute that precedes bina, and it means becoming perceptive, learning to perceive. What's going on here? I noticed something. So the capacity to notice is an attribute of leadership. You might not have connected the dots yet. That's bina. I now have... the ability to discern what's going on. I can put two and two together. I can connect the dots. That's discernment. But before you get to discernment, you got to go through this. You know, what's going on here? Why do they use that term? So that's just a little side note on part of leadership. I think I covered the salient things I wanted to cover. I wanted to just get you stimulated to think about and... Yeah, if you're a leader, there's a heavy responsibility. And, of course, for an elder, there's a promise of an extra crown for doing it well. You're just not a businessman called to sit in Como once a month and listen to the financial reports.
What would be a good book that a person wanted to know? This is kind of a new concept.
That's a great question. There's an increasing number of books out on the role of love in leadership. A great book, really, on giving is Give and Take by Adam Grant. He's a professor at Wharton, but it's a fun book to read because it's a combination of examples and research. And he looks at sports stars and business stars and government people, givers. Another fun book that sort of is more proscriptive in a sense is the guy who was and he's a believer, he's a Christian, who was on Undercover Boss, Manby. And he was became CEO of the big properties, the family properties like Silver Dollar City. They own 26 properties around the country. And it's a love-based corporation. And so there's no research. You're reading his experience. But it's a fun read.